Tokyo Podcast episode number 18.
On this show, I'll be talking to Mr. William Saito, who is an accomplished entrepreneur, venture capitalist, and educator, and he'll be talking about entrepreneurialism and innovation in Japan. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tokyo Podcast. I am your host, Anthony Joe. And if you're listening to this in Tokyo, how did you enjoy the little bit of snow that we had this morning? It was kind of nice to see a little dusting of the white stuff that Tokyo got. People were posting pictures on Twitter and Facebook showing a little bit of snow that had landed on their neighborhood. Personally, for me, I come from Vancouver, Canada, where we used to get snow almost, you know, every year. And I got to say, I didn't miss the snow when I moved to Thailand at first, not having to shovel it, not having to commute in it, you know. But after being in Thailand for, you know, a number of years and not seeing any snow at all, it was kind of nice to wake up this morning and see a little light dusting out there. So I actually hope it snows a lot more because I think Tokyo must look really nice with a layer of snow. And then the rain come and wash it all away before everybody has to go back to work. So, but if you're thinking about stuff to do when it's snowing out, check out my latest video that I posted of my recent trip to Joyopolis. Joyopolis is this multi-story amusement entertainment center that was built by Sega, the video game company, and this is all on the man-made island of Odaiba, about 30 minutes outside of Tokyo. And I really like that area. Whenever I used to come visit to Japan, I used to always go to Joyopolis because it's just so much fun. They've got an indoor roller coaster. They've got this half pipe that makes you feel like you're on a snowboard. They got hundreds of video games and all sorts of virtual reality rides. And it's a really, really great place. If you got a family and if you're coming to Tokyo and you're looking for something like that the whole family can do, from teenagers to young kids, I think Joyopolis at Odaiba is a really good place to visit. And besides Joyopolis, there's also, they got a really nice boardwalk there with a whole bunch of restaurants. There's a number of shopping malls and complexes around there. There's one that's designed to look like Venice. It's kind of neat. The whole inside, the ceiling is painted like clouds and all the buildings are kind of look like the Venetian style. They got this big Venetian water fountain in the middle. And if you're a car guy, at this mall, there's this really cool Toyota Historic Car Museum. And it's, I believe it's like two or three levels. But inside, it's a static display. All the cars are just kind of lined up. But they've got the whole environment around the car decorated and designed to resemble that era of the car. So you can go, there's some American cars, and all around they've got like an American diner. They've got American movies playing in the background, and they got like classic Japanese cars and all this kind of stuff. So if you go to Odaiba, if you're a car guy, definitely go check that out. I went recently to Joyopolis and I posted a video of that on my website at tokyopodcast.com/joyopolis. So check that out and let me know what you think. So in today's show, I'll be talking to Mr. William Saito, who is an accomplished entrepreneur. He is a venture capitalist and educator, and he's an advisor to governments worldwide. And he writes a very excellent blog at saitohome.com where he talks about entrepreneurialism and innovation, and specifically how those two topics relate to Japan. Many of his posts tend to be a little bit critical of the entrepreneurialism and innovative spirit here in Japan. And I thought it'd be interesting to have him on the show to talk about, you know, what he sees as kind of the problems, the stumbling blocks, and any kind of solutions that he can offer. So that's coming up a little bit later on the show. But first, I want to talk about JBN. JBN stands for Japan Blog Network, and it's something that I'm introducing on Tokyo Podcast where I bring you some of the latest postings from the more interesting blogs here in Japan. You know, Japan's got a really good blog network. I think the quality of many of the blogs here are really top-notch compared to many other countries I've lived in. And the blog community is a really, really good close-knit group. So JBN is going to be my attempt to bring to you some of the more interesting blogs that I've seen online. So the first blog I want to talk about is hikosaimen.com. And as you know, Hikosaimen has a very popular YouTube channel, but he actually also has a very good blog too that I definitely recommend checking out. And this particular post, he talks about the story that ran in the Economist magazine about the case of the Canadian journalist, Mr. Christopher Johnson, who was recently denied entry into Japan. Christopher claims that he was roughed up and detained at Narita Airport and forced at gunpoint to purchase an outgoing ticket and was basically forced out of Japan. The blog sphere has reacted quite strongly to this article, some people claiming that there seems to be a lot of discrepancies in the story that's posted on The Economist and other people wondering how legitimate it is. But Hikosaimen's blog post has a very good summary of all the different articles and videos that people have responded to in regards to this story. So definitely check that out at hikosaimen.com. The second blog I want to talk about today is by a longtime blogger here who goes by the name Loco in Yokohama. And he has recently released his first book called Hi, My Name is Loco and I Am a Racist. It is written by Mr. Bay McNeil and it chronicles his journey from America to Japan and his dealings with racism here in Japan and both within himself. The blog sphere has given this book tremendously positive reviews and I will have Mr. McNeil on the show in a couple weeks to give a full review of his book and to talk about his personal experiences. But if you can't wait and you want to get a hold of the book now, go visit the website hi.mynameisloco.com and you can order his book from his website or you can order it from Amazon as well. And like I said, everyone who's read the book so far has given it a very positive review. So I will post links to both of those sites from my website at tokyopodcast.com. And if you have a blog post that you want to be featured on the show, feel free to send me an email at anthony@tokyopodcast.com and I'd be happy to get that on for you. Today I have the privilege of talking to Mr. William Saito, who is one of the world's leading experts in the field of information and data security, with a specialty in biometrics. At the age of 10, he was designing stock market trading algorithms for Merrill Lynch, and by the time he was in college, he was creating software programs for tech giants such as NEC, Toshiba, and Sony. In 1988, he was named Entrepreneur of the Year by Ernst & Young, NASDAQ, and USA Today. His patented encryption authentication biometric technologies have been licensed by over 160 companies around the world. In 2005, he moved to Japan and founded Integer, which assists entrepreneurs and companies to turn innovation into globally viable products and services. A frequent author on entrepreneurialism, William Saito was honored in 2011 by the World Economic Forum as both a young global leader and Global Agenda Council member. His autobiography, An Unprogrammed Life, Adventures of an Incurable Entrepreneur, was published in 2011. I'm pleased to have Mr. William Saito here today. Welcome.
Yep, thank you for having me.
Now, I am a huge fan of your blog. I've been reading it for quite some time, and I find it a fascinating insight into entrepreneurialism. And so I thought it would be an interesting topic to talk about entrepreneurialism in Japan. And I wanted to ask you kind of the big question, the elephant in the room is entrepreneurialism dead in Japan?
No, I don't think so. I think entrepreneurialism is alive and well. It really depends on how you define entrepreneurialism. And in my case, I actually look at entrepreneurialism not necessarily creating companies, that entrepreneurialism is really a mindset where it's a valuable tool to allow people to express their creativity and turn it into something, whether it's a service, a product, a new company, maybe even a new industry. And so what I try to do is stay away necessarily from starting a venture, but showing how it's applicable to everything from governments to large businesses to academia. And so if you look at that, there are different levels of entrepreneurial activity all around, maybe perhaps not at the large levels that you see in Silicon Valley, perhaps, but there are bits and pieces that really exemplify the strength of Japan.
When you moved from doing business in the U.S. to Japan, what were some of the challenges that you encountered?
In my case, I was quite lucky because when I started my company, a lot of it was Japan-related. Since I have a Japanese background, the language wasn't as tough. However, when you look Japanese, people tend to expect you to speak perfect Japanese, so there was some trouble there. But growing past that, I guess the always ongoing problem or issues that I see when dealing with Japan is that it still tends to be a little bit age and seniority based. Now that I've aged a little bit more since I've started working here, it's become a not as pronounced, but from time to time, you do get an older generation, in my case, people in their 70s and 80s, that you sometimes bump heads with.
Was it quite a shock to you coming from kind of the free-willing Silicon Valley area to the more strict, rigid bureaucracy of Japan?
I knew about this, perhaps superficially. I've read about it. I've kind of experienced it as a businessman doing business coming from the United States into Japan. But to live here and to actually live it day to day and go into the depth of the beast, as you would say, it has been interesting just because you at first didn't understand why they were doing it. But when you understand the reasoning for this, some of it makes sense. Some of it gets even more mysterious. So for me, it was kind of half-half. It was definitely an interesting experience, but you could also understand some of why things are the way they are.
Do you think that Japan has advantages? Like, what advantages does this system have versus the West?
I, on average, every year travel between 30 and 40 countries around the world. They ask me and the government of Japan, for example, on how to implement, for example, a science technology policy in country X or country Y. And so these countries, they're very passionate and they have a lot of, for example, raw materials and money and forethought. But you come back and what I really am proud of coming back to Japan is to understand that Japan has probably the most valuable natural resource, and that's probably its educational base, its educated people, its innovative base. And so that area, I could probably say with pretty good confidence that Japan is second to none. It's converting that innovation into something that's practical, into something that people want, into actual products that are competitive on a global basis that Japan's having a problem with.
You mentioned this on your blog. You call it the last mile.
Yep.
Where you can take innovation and bring it to market. And you also mentioned on your blog that Japan kind of hit a wall in regards to innovation after the collapse of the bubble. What do you think the difference was back then that they were able to go that extra mile, the last mile, and now that they seem like they cannot?
Yeah, no, and that's actually a very good point. So I call that the last mile because if you think about, say, the trek from a country's competitiveness starting out from mile zero and to have like a successful Silicon Valley model being mile 100, Japan actually has really the last mile left, where many of the other countries, back to my earlier point, have to build the educational base, they have to build the university infrastructure, they have to build several generations of qualified graduates. They need to build something that will take years that you just can't do overnight. Whereas when you have an innovation base that's just sitting there, to convert that into a tangible product or a well-run company, you can actually get these things by buying or by bringing in from overseas or even growing them from domestically in a lot less time, effort, money than many of these emerging countries have to start to build. And so from that perspective, the last mile, what I call last mile, is really the easy part that's left. And it, from most Japanese companies and people's standpoint, it looks really, really far away. But from the relative perspective of other countries and such, what one needs to do here is definitely a lot, lot less than many of these other countries. And so I think the challenges are a lot less. So back to the original question of what's different between the bubble era and now, I think, and I have a new book on this coming out later this spring on this. This will unfortunately or unfortunately be in Japanese, which really talks about this difference. Where post-war Japan, you had a system where the country was decimated, had to rebuild. It had and still does not have very many natural resources. And so Meiji, the predecessor to Meiji, really organized and focused a lot of Japanese industries to take what limited resources they have and focus them into certain areas and concentrate them. The car industry, for example, the electronics, IC, microchip-type industries and other specialized areas that Japan was famous for in the 90s. And this was important because it focused Japan to use its limited resource to be number one in certain key areas. And that was all fine and good when institutions like Meiji led this charge and organized the companies and were able to define and create a structure that allowed Japan Inc. to move forward. The problem is what happened since then is we have the word globalization, and yes, this is an overused term, but what this means is the global challenges and the global competitiveness and the global threats really overcame the capacity of Meiji to understand what people needed. And so as long as Japan had the direction of a strong leader and were told to do this or that and was provided a good strategy, it was possible for them to really focus and get ahead. Now, when you have global competitiveness and different needs and changing markets as fast as they do, even for Meiji, it's very hard to catch up. And because the Japanese industry behemoth was really counting on a strong leader like that to continue to provide that leadership, and that because they're not able to, we've seen, especially the last 20 years, innovation and global competitiveness from a Japan perspective go down because now they have to think for themselves.
How do you think they can get that back? You know, certain Japanese companies like Nissan, for example, has done quite well with a foreign CEO. Do you think that's a direction that they could head to try to get that leadership back?
Yeah, so I use the word global not as a cliche, but one of the things is obviously if you want to create a globally competitive product, you need to be globally aware. You really need to know what the difference between want and need are. And I think many Japanese ventures or even large Japanese companies don't understand that concept. They think that they can make something cool and people come knocking on the doors, whereas they don't realize that the rest of the world may not be able to afford an $800 cell phone. That's hard to use and you don't know what most of the functions are, for example. And so to be globally minded is what is that's really what it means. It doesn't necessarily mean to open up a store in Thailand, for example. It means to understand what the Thais need from their relative perspective and to understand what is important, what isn't important. And in order to do that, you need to have people who have experienced and lived overseas to understand different cultures and to be able to apply those differences and create different products. Japan, for better or for worse, has really been one culture. And so if you sell to the Japanese, you make for the Japanese and you can sell to the Japanese, that was fine. But when you have a situation where a country has both the fastest aging population and the fastest shrinking population because of low birth rates, by default, you have a shrinking market. So as a company, it's almost mandatory that you need to look overseas or else you're basically assuming your market share will decrease. And so to get that global perspective is so important since you can't sustain yourself in this country by itself.
What are your thoughts on where Japan is with that? You know, I come from Canada and there's lots of Chinese companies that are doing business in Canada and I see Chinese and Korean businessmen all the time. How does Japanese, you know, Japan Inc., as you call it, do on the international scale?
It's obvious. I don't need to be the one to tell, but tell anyone. But the presence of Japanese companies overseas has decreased substantially. When one might have seen Sony signs 10 years ago in streets of Europe, now they're replaced by Samsung. So you know, nothing wrong with that. But from a global presence And to go out, Japan has definitely taken it on the chin. And from a understanding of what people want and to keep up with the innovation and the change of how ICT has, for example, changed the world and such, they've been caught flat-footed. And you have a lot more scrappier companies come up out of nowhere and create products that not only are innovative, but they have addressed issues like globalization by allowing people to customize what they buy, especially in ICT. So the cell phone of today, for example, if I buy an iPhone, my iPhone is always going to be different from my friend's iPhone because of what I load on it, what I put on it, and so on. Whereas the Japanese model, they've kind of extended the mass production effect, and you create these products that have all the features for the greatest common denominator, yet most of the people don't know how to use. And in the end, that makes no one happy because it ends up creating a more expensive, less useful, at least relative to the price, product. And so I wouldn't say that that's a way to have for how the Japanese have addressed the globalization issue by putting more features into it. But it's showed a lesson in that ways of innovation, ways of productization, how companies approach markets, how companies enter new markets has in itself changed. And I think that by having less and less presence, not only in companies being overseas, but students going to universities overseas, this is a result.
Yeah, I did read that the number of students from Japan who are studying abroad is decreasing every year, and it's lower, obviously, than China and Korea. How is that going to affect future Japan?
At its present rate, it's probably going to make things a lot worse. I think that 2011, you saw a slight increase in people going overseas just because of the government's concerted efforts. But overall, when you have a situation where you have several hundred Koreans and Chinese and Indians going to Harvard, and in 2011 there was only one Japanese undergraduate, the scale is completely different. And while some people may say that that's just a fluke or that people are going to different colleges or so on, the fact of the matter is that the absolute number of Japanese that are going overseas and understanding different cultures and forming the networks is decreasing. One of the ways one can measure this is what I use to explain is the number of PCT, international patent applications, that people file. And the tendency that you see is that you can almost correlate the value of a company by the number of patents that it files jointly with other companies, even potential competitors for that matter. And you look at all the valuable companies in the world, and you look at their patent filings, and you'll see that they're not only filed by the company A, but they're also having joint authorship by company B and company C and company D. And it's a sharing of ideas and creating relationships and basically growing an industry. Versus if you look at a lot of the patent applications from a Japanese company, they tend to be just that company. And there's very little sharing and so on. So what happens there is even in that example, the companies that do this, the Japanese companies in this example, lose context. That they don't know necessarily what their peers are doing, what the industry in general is doing. So they may file more patents, but the quality of their patents and the relevance of the patents are differently lower.
Do you think that this is as a result of kind of Japanese corporate culture? For example, a friend of mine in Thailand worked for Honda. And, I'm a huge car fan. And we used to talk about the car industry a lot. And he mentioned that, you know, America's got the big three. And he said in Japan, there's 11 different car manufacturers, and that the Japanese market is so competitive that most of the profit comes from overseas. But that's getting eaten alive by Hyundai and various other companies. So the logical thought that kind of goes through my Western brain is, why don't these Honda and et cetera companies merge together? But he said that it's kind of a cultural thing, that if you're, say, a Mitsubishi or a Toyota man, you can't merge with Suzuki or Honda. So you have this culture clash that keeps all these companies separate, and yet they're getting clobbered by the competition in the West and in Europe, who have merged together.
I wouldn't necessarily say that merger is the way to save the industry in itself. I think that in the Japanese cultural perspective, that they don't merge is probably a defensive mechanism, because if you see a lot of the mergers, especially in like the finance industries, you'll have banks that have mergers, you know, umpteenth time, and you'll end up still having like four HR divisions because they still can't integrate it, and they'll have four IT divisions because they can't integrate it and such. So merging doesn't necessarily mean the economies of scale like you see in other Western companies. And obviously in Western companies, not all mergers go well. I think that what's ultimately going to happen is more Darwinistic, and that the less capable car companies will just fail. And I think that's probably the more natural way of going. I don't think, and this is probably why they realize and probably why you don't see that much, is that merging two so-so companies will probably create a less than so-so company.
You mentioned on your blog an interesting paragraph talking about the phrase made in Japan. How has that changed over the last 20 years? What does made in Japan mean now, do you think?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's interesting. So I used to joke, in the 1980s, it was Japan bashing. In the 1990s, 2000, was Japan passing. And now it's really Japan missing. To its credit, Japan has, for example, converted and changed where the United States used to be its largest trading partner. Now it's China. And this changeover is tremendous if you think about it. One of the interesting things that I heard was when the Shanghai World Expo happened last year, there were a number of Japanese companies that exhibited. And from at least an Asian perspective in Southeast and Far East Asia, the Made in Japan label, especially for luxury items like clothing or food or things like that, still have a tremendous value. And that a lot of, especially Chinese tourists that come to Japan, for example, look for that mark. I think separately, you have a situation where that marketing isn't done so well. One good example is you see the Welcome to Japan posters that JETRO puts out at Narita Airport when you arrive. Well, why do you put such posters when you've already arrived? I think it's more important that you want people to come to Japan. But if they're already here, they're a captured audience. So, you know, I don't quite understand the point of that. Whereas I think JETRO should learn from other countries and their experience in publicizing their countries and attracting and having them more visit from overseas and get them on the plane. I don't see much point in appealing to them after they're already here. The other example I see is that because of that last, the other question, the presence overseas from these Japanese companies have decreased such that there are generations of people now who think that Sony is a U.S. company. And, you know, that might be good. But it probably shows that there's less care in that as well. When the Japanese GDP went from number two to number three, people didn't care. So, I don't know. I think from a made in Japan, you see some of it in terms of quality, but you know it's only in relatively small areas. When you think about made in Japan, just even a decade ago, it led in half a dozen major industries. Now it doesn't lead in any major industry, and so it's hard to say what made in Japan really means.
How do you think they can get that back? What do you think Japan has to do to kind of reboot the system and get going again?
Yeah, that's a very good question. That you may need a second podcast to cover that point. The book that I'm actually coming out with, one of the discussions there is so as I said, I go overseas quite a bit, and one of the things I do and I enjoy is I judge a lot of business plan competitions. Mm-hmm. And as of like last May, I've judged my 10,000th business plan. So I've seen quite a few. And one of the ones that I enjoy a lot is the worldwide competition where you have elementary, junior high, and high school kids present their business plans, and it's quite cute. And the thing I noticed was, up until about the third grade, the Japanese students don't really lose out to any other country. They're as entrepreneurial and as competitive as ever. And from like the fourth grade, they fall off a cliff. And I wondered why. And so for Japan to fix itself and to change, one of the things I realized was that the education system, and something happens at about third or fourth grade, where the students there become ultra competitive and they become very mindful of just themselves. Meaning, the easiest way to describe it is, so one good example is they end up going to juku, the cram schools. And cram schools, I look at this as really a bad thing in that they're trained from some as early as 5 years old to get into todai. And that competition basically pits one person against the other. So, you know, if that person gets in, there's a chance you may not get in because he takes your slot. And it creates this competitive environment, let alone this uselessness in just memorizing facts and such that I could probably Google in half a second. It teaches the what, and fact fills your head with all these things. And makes you a very good test taker, but it doesn't ask more questions about, you know, why things are the way they are, and doesn't have the, it doesn't teach people how to ask questions. But more importantly, this individualism that they teach here, and it's either you or me kind of thing, and you get into this, and once they get into todai, they have this 4 year vacation. Where it's this, you know, congratulations, you got in, you could relax for 4 years. And then they go in and go into the job market. They're expected to work as teams. When they've been programmed for, in some cases, you know, 15, 20 years to compete against each other. And so you have this society now where it's very hard to work in teams. So the theme of my next book is about how Japan is actually not very good at teamwork.
That's interesting, because that's kind of a contrary to what many people think, right? Yeah, they think that group mentality, group work together.
Yeah, and that's exactly the point. So I say that Japan is actually not very good in teams. It's actually very good in group work. So when you have strong institutions like MITI with a strong leadership that tells people to do this, this, and this, you know, to the exact T, group work is very efficient. It's like, you know, commanding an army. But when you have situations where innovation moves at the rapid pace that it does, where you have corporations that have different silos of technology, they may have a music group, they may have a pictures group, they may have a computers group, they may have a cell phone group, but because they're so competitive, even though they're within that same company, that they can't put together an iPhone, it shows this lack of teamwork. And that's just one example. You know, the bureaucracy, the politics in Japan, where you have an incident like March 11th, yet the minority ruling party will just sit there and not help, is unfathomable for me. As a human being or as a nation, one should usually come together and try to find these solutions and such, yet I can also understand why they are the way they are, because they're not trained to work together. They're not trained to be empathetic. They're not trained to volunteer. They're not trained to be philanthropic. They're trained to get into todai and get a good job and get on that escalator and retire at X age. And it's very programmed into it. And anything that veers off that is probably not to your betterment. Hence, they don't do. And I think that's completely wrong. Whereas if you think about the very model of innovation or the very model of entrepreneurship, if you look at all the successful companies in the world, they weren't magically, they don't magically come out of thin air. They grow up and stand on the shoulders of many that come before them. They are the result of the help of many, many people who help them get to where they are. And so, you know, that aspect is lost with the Japanese people, where if I want to start a business or if I want to do something, no one helps them. You know, who provides the money? Who provides the guidance? Who provides the support? Who provides the advice? Who connects them with customers? There's very little of that here. Whereas in the U.S. or other countries, for that matter, because I don't try to make this U.S.-centric, I think, you know, successful entrepreneurial countries in the world share the similar quality, where society has that philosophy to want to help each other and they support each other. And, you know, things like volunteerism isn't scary, that they do this. And so to introduce one to a lawyer, introduce one to an investor, or to introduce one to a customer is... So anybody who listens to your podcast from the Western world will think, well, of course, if someone asks me and if I know that person, yeah, sure, I'll introduce. Whereas in Japan, they're worried about their reputation, or they're worried about, you know, all sorts of reasons, like, well, I could introduce, but how about if he fails, and, you know, I've introduced a bad person. There's 1,000 reasons, but the general tendency is that you see very rare cases of people wanting to help people from an organic perspective.
What advice then would you give for young entrepreneurs in Japan to seek out that partnership?
Yeah, so what I do is, so when I teach classes at different universities in Japan, I tell them that teamwork is important. But not only that, one of the other problems with Japanese education is that around high school, your life is basically determined for you, that, you know, you're going to be a doctor, you're going to be a lawyer, you're going to be working for a gaimusho or something based on that test. Hence, when you become, like, for example, a scientist, you're going to be on that one track to go, and all you learn is science, and you interact with science. Okay, not everything is science, but what happens is you end up interacting with a lot of your peer groups, which is it's very, very dangerous, because it doesn't add diversity and different thoughts to how a product or company should be formed. If you're looking at a larger market, you have all sorts of people who will use your products in many different ways. And so you need to take those perspectives into account. If your people who create this product or company don't have that diversity, you end up creating a product that only works for, like, gadget nerds or some fashion niche. And so you see this. So the thing I tell people, especially in the classes that I do, is to work with people in specialties that are not your own. So sciences and humanities should mix. Women should get more involved. That women are definitely an underutilized talent in Japan. That diversity, because, you know, they make 51% of the population here. If you don't know how to sell to them, you've lost half the market, for example. So, you know, to have that diversity and to create a structure where you complement your weaknesses. You admit what your weaknesses are, to know what your weaknesses are, and to complement those by filling them in with people that may be smarter than you. And to put that pride aside and to create a team that works harmoniously. That's the most important thing. And then the other thing I say for me to invest, for example, is that they have to have failed at least once, which is unheard of in Japan, because, you know, if you fail once here, typically, you know, you probably have to move to Hokkaido or something. But, you know, all those other companies that we spoke about earlier, they all failed at something once before. The many, many companies that I've judged, for example, 99% of them have at least failed once, and it's their second venture that is succeeding. So for me to invest, if it's their first venture, I know relatively with high certainty that they're going to fail. So if I know that, then why do I want to, like, throw my money away if I know they're going to fail? I want to invest in someone who has experienced failure and understands their limitations and could learn from that aspect, because if it's their first time, I know they're going to fail. If it's their second time, they may have learned something. So what I always say is the opposite of success. So I ask these people, you know, what is the opposite of success? And most people say failure. And I go, no. Opposite of success is not failure. It's actually not trying. And that failure is actually a education mode. And obviously, if you don't learn from your failure, then you're just a true failure. But failures are opportunities to learn, and that's what I try to show people and to make people understand that failure is not a bad thing. Failure is actually, I mean, I don't really intentionally encourage it, but failure is important in terms of understanding what you're good at and what you're bad at, how to complement that, and to learn what to not do again. And so these things are absolutely educational and absolutely necessary for successful companies to grow.
I think that's one of the biggest differences between the West and Japan, is that employees and entrepreneurs in the West, we have this mindset that if we fail, everything will still be all right. We still live in a first world country, you know, so it's not going to be dramatic where we'll be homeless. Certainly there's that possible risk, depending on how much you risk it. But I think most people have this kind of thinking that if company X doesn't work out, there's three or four kind of lined up. Whereas I think maybe here that mindset is not quite in place, is it? They think that if I risk something at this company, I've got nothing.
Yeah, but I think we're coming to a tipping point here where the working environment has become so bad in some cases that the trade-off between leaving that company and starting a venture or working with a friend or even a better company versus staying there and just being miserable is really at that tipping point now, I think, in Japan. And I think, in a sense, we're finally at a point where we're showing that the king has no clothes. And so you're going to see a big change, I think, because of that. And I don't think that's because of 3.11 or anything like that. It was something that's been building over the last 20 years.
Okay. Last question. What motivates you?
It really motivates... What really motivates me is the fact that what I'm doing right now is having some small, visible, measurable change. To see ex-students of mine who ended up working for some shosha or some brokerage emailing me a year later and saying they've quit and they've started a company. Mm. That what I've been yelling about up and down, words like entrepreneurship and innovation have become less of a bad word. That the word globalism is finally, people are starting to understand this and going, wow, okay, finally. I'm not taking credit for this necessarily, but I'm saying finally people are beginning to understand what this means and how Japan can no longer stay the Galapagos of this area, and that it needs to take proactive action, and that given what I originally said about how the Japan having the most valuable natural resource, which is this intellect and its innovation base, once we could unleash that again, it'll be tremendous. So it's tremendously passionate. I have tremendous passion. And in a sense, it's often said that Japanese, but, you know, in humans in general, they have to go through some level of adversity to have things kick in. And because of 3.11, and while that in itself has been horrible, it has been a wake-up call, and people are beginning to go, wow, I need to take responsibility for myself. I need to start doing things here. I cannot necessarily trust the state or my company or whatever. And they're having their, you know, awakening, and you're seeing tremendous change. If you look at all the famous companies in Japan that everybody around the world knows, they were all formed during some sort of calamity. So I think that right now, the next Sony will probably come out of the Tohoku region. And I would kick myself if, you know, I wasn't part of that. So, yeah, a lot of interest here in this area right now.
Well, as bad as things look, there's still that light at the end of the tunnel. Well, as they say, a turning point.
Well, as they say, you know, all problems are just opportunities. So
true. If people want to find out more about your book and your website, which I highly recommend, it is one of the most the best entrepreneurial blogs online. It's called saitohome.com. And I will post a link to both of those from my website at tokyopodcast.com. Thank you very much for coming on the show. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thanks again to William Saito for coming on the show. I really enjoyed listening to someone who has spent so much time traveling around the world and seeing the effects of entrepreneurialism and innovation. If you want to check out more of his writings, visit his website at saitohome.com, S-A-I-T-O-H-O-M-E.com, and also check out his book, An Unprogrammed Life, Adventures of an Incurable Entrepreneur, which is in bookstores now. And you can also find him on Twitter at W-H-S-A-I-T-O. I really enjoyed the answer that he gave for what motivates him, because in my own small way, being able to make an impact on other people's lives is what has motivated me to create this podcast. My business in Canada was a very financially successful business for me, but it did not make a huge impact on people's lives, and especially after I sold it. And I really realized, just like William said, is that to make an impact, to start any kind of large company, if you're a solo entrepreneur, if you're trying to do it all yourself, you really are quite limited as to what you can do. Some of the more successful entrepreneurs and businessmen that you see, part of their success, actually, I think a large chunk of their success comes from the team that they're able to assemble around them. And so my goal with this podcast is to have a positive impact on the audience's life. And I realize that there's only so much I can do myself. There's only so many people that are going to relate to me. But my hope is that every time I have a new guest on, that extends the reach of the show to people who may not normally have tuned in. And they have that connection with that guest, and then that connection encourages them to make positive changes in their life as well. So, fascinating interview. I hope you enjoyed that. I really did. And don't forget to check out my new Japan Blog Network. The story we featured this week is of Canadian journalist Christopher Johnson's getting kicked out of Japan at Narita Airport. All the details of that can be found on hikosimon.com. And also, a prominent blogger here in Japan has released his first book. Mr. Bay McNeil has released a book called Hi, My Name is Local and I Am a Racist, talking about racism in Japan. He'll be on the show in a couple weeks to give a full account of his book, and I'm very looking forward to that as well. If you have an interesting story or a blog that you want to be featured on Tokyo Podcast, feel free to send me an email at tokyopodcast.com. You can also check out my Facebook page at facebook.com/tokyopodcast, or talk to me on Twitter at Tokyo Podcast as well. That's it. Thanks for listening, everyone. I'm Anthony Joe, and bye-bye.